From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. On our last episode of All Songs Considered, we talked about record labels and whether they still matter. If the answer was ever in doubt, just look at Merge Records and all it's contributed to the musical landscape. Bands like Spoon, M. Ward, The Magnetic Fields, Neutral Milk Hotel, Conor Oberst, Lamb Chop, The Shout Out Louds, and many, many more, including this group, Arcade Fire. This year, Merge Records celebrates its 20th anniversary. It started in 1989 in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, with two people, Mac McConn and Laura Balance. They started Merge Records because they were both in a couple of bands and wanted to put out records. At first, it was handmade cassettes. They sold maybe 50 or 100 at a time. But today, Merge Records is one of the most revered labels in the business, with a roster of remarkable artists releasing special edition vinyl albums, box sets, CDs, digital downloads, and books. I talked recently with Mac McConn and Laura Balance about the history of Merge Records. We begin by looking back 20 years at some of the labels that got them both into music.
And there were certain labels that, I mean, Flying Nun's a good example, that's a New Zealand label. That was the sort of thing where it was so hard to find something on Flying Nun, and you would read about bands and hear about bands, that when you found anything, I would just buy it. Even if I had never even heard of that band. If it was on Flying Nun, I was like, I'm sure this is good, I'm just going to get it. And 90% of the time, it was true. And I think that when we started in terms of American independent labels, growing up in high school, being into hardcore and punk rock and stuff like that, labels represented certain regions of the country in a way. It was kind of, there was a regional thing going on with Discord in D.C., you know, SST was out in Los Angeles. You had a label like Reflex or Twin Tone in Minneapolis. And so you could, Tang in Boston, you could follow these things. And you had it was like an organizing principle in a way, as well as signifying a certain thing that you knew you were going to get from even, buying import records, a record on 4AD or Factory or something like that meant a certain thing. And I think that really influenced us and what we wanted to do, and when we were starting a few years later, and it was, those were models of labels that represented something and that you trusted them.
So what label would represent Chapel Hill in 1989?
There wasn't one, I don't think.
And is that part of the impetus for doing it? I mean, did you see, when you start this label to put out the Superchunk record, did you see yourselves as doing anything more than just putting out the Superchunk record? Did you see yourself as representing anything local?
When we started out, we weren't actually putting out Superchunk records. The first few releases were by other bands, mostly ones that Mac was in, and some of them that I was also in.
You want to name one? We'll play one.
Wax. W-W-A-X.
And there was a band called Bricks, also B-R-I-C-K-S, normal spelling of Bricks.
Let's play a song by Bricks for a minute, and this is called A History of Lies.
I guess, like what Laura was saying, there was no other label at the time, and nor was any label coming to us. We had just started what would become Superchunk, we were called Chunk at the time. But, no one was coming to us saying, can we put out your records, please? So it just seemed like...
Well, what about sending your records to some of those labels that you did like? I mean, in terms of like sort of painting the landscape, which I think is really helpful for someone who is, you know, 18 years old to have no idea what it means, what a fanzine means to you then, and what a cassette tape means, and like help us paint that picture. Your band, you're getting started.
I guess your options are kind of what you just said. You could make a demo tape and send it off and hope that someone else would be interested in it.
Right.
Yeah, or you could just do it yourself. And so, you know, while it would have been awesome to have a record on Homestead, for instance, the idea of sending a demo tape off and kind of hoping for a response just wasn't as appealing as doing it ourselves if we knew that we could do it ourselves. And we had models for doing it ourselves, so that seemed to be the way to go.
If it's okay, I'd like to get really specific about those models, because I think I think people who've never done this. I started a label in 79. It was just a few bands. It was me, the band I was in, Tiny Desk Unit, and another band called Yugoslavia, and that was a whole label. But the idea of like starting a label and walking into a small independent store and saying, "Hey, I'm with this label, and I got these records, and I got a box in my car," and can you just sort of take us through a little of that?
I mean, in some ways, I think it was easier for us being in a small town because, you know, we either worked at the record store or knew people working at the record store at the time. And so there was a little bit of an immediacy that you could achieve. I mean, I remember our first release was a cassette by the band Brix, and I remember bringing it up to the record store. And
I had made a special presentation box for it to sit
tell
on the
me about
counter.
That.
A display case.
A display case. It was like a cassette-sized box that could fit like 10 cassettes or something, and I had covered it in velvet and made it so it was slightly angled towards the viewer.
So it might sit near the cash register there and whatever.
Yeah. And of course, and we brought it up there, and they were just like, "No one's going to buy these." You know? but they're friends of ours, so they're like, "All right, just set it, you know, put it on the thing, put it by the cash register."
And at what price did this sell at?
Oh,
I have no idea.
Was it one song?
$5.99? I don't know.
Was it a bunch of songs?
Yeah, it was about 8 songs, I think. And keep in mind, we're dubbing these at home on a dubbing deck.
Yes.
And we did have sleeves printed, but we're, you know, making all the tapes ourselves, one tape after another. It is, I mean, like you said, like someone growing up today, it is hard to imagine just compared to now how little, or compared to then how much stuff there is now.
Yeah.
That if you're just wanting to learn about new bands or whatever, it's overwhelming because of the internet, you know. At the time, you could get people's attention with a cassette or a 7-inch, you know, and a couple fanzine reviews and some college radio stations playing it. You know, people could find out about that.
And so it became not just local. There were also, maybe it was different when you had your label, Bob, but at this point there was a system. There were some indie distributors around, and we sent them a copy of whatever we put out, and then we would call them and solicit orders, and they would order them.
And they would order them so that the Dutch East India Trading guy would go to a bunch of record stores and say, "I have this new record by, you know, Brix or whatever." And so this became sort of national. This was sort of a way to get your stuff out by putting it in the hands of one company to get it out into a bunch of other hands. And a lot of mom and pops would buy from these sorts of things, and they'd order one or they'd order two, right? I mean, that's sort of how it
right.
worked until
yeah.
it added up to that 100, that magic number of 100 or whatever that you'd hope to sell.
Yeah.
That's sort of it.
And then we'd collect payment from the distributor, hopefully.
Or they would go out of business.
Yes,
or they would go out of business.
owing everyone a bunch of money.
At what point did it become difficult to dub the cassettes on your own? Was there a record in particular? Well, it was always difficult, but at what point? But was there a record that you put out that all of a sudden you needed 100, you needed 500, you needed more than you could really do on your own, that you said, "This is getting a little bigger"?
Sure. Well, once we started doing 7-inch singles, we abandoned cassettes pretty quickly. And so Superchunk ended up signing to Matador Records to do full-length albums because Merge, we couldn't afford to make a press an LP or make CDs, or you know, that just required a lot more capital than we had.
In other words, your credit card would have way maxed out, that you couldn't go up to a company, because usually the minimum pressings were 500 or 1,000. You couldn't lay out enough money to press 1,000 records or albums. Is that
sure? I think at that stage in our lives, neither of us had a credit card. Even back then, yeah. Credit cards weren't so easy
to get.
That's
right, exactly.
In
fact, your own credit card with the
right.
Yeah, which is where
carve
the word chip
out
comes
of a
from.
Bar of soap. So Superchunk signed to Matador to do our albums, and meanwhile we kept kind of this parallel course going with Merge operating, still doing 7 inches and things like that. But around 92, we wanted to put out a compilation. We wanted to stop having to press all the Superchunk 7 inches that we had done up to that point and just make a compilation album of those singles, and we wanted to do it on Merge. So we entered into a partnership with Touch and Go Records in Chicago, and they helped us manufacture and distribute Merge full-length releases. And that's, to me, that's kind of the first milestone in terms of when Merge really changed and became something other than us doing stuff in, stuffing records in Laura's house, basically, you know.
We should probably play some music because it's been a bit. We should play something maybe. Should we play something off the first Superchunk album, or what would be a good?
Sure. Well, we could play something from the Superchunk, from Tossing Seeds, which was that singles compilation that was the first full length that we did on Merge. This is a song that we put out on a single called, it was a single that had a song called Cool and a song called Fishing on it, and it ended up on the first full length that we did on Merge, which was called Tossing Seeds, and it's called Cool.
Great. So were you all doing day jobs and stuff like that as well as a band and a label? I mean, is this any of this making anything, putting anything into your pockets yet?
No.
Yeah.
Definitely had day jobs.
Yeah. And doing what, real quickly?
We worked at Pepper's Pizza for a while.
Kinko's was
and
a big employer of Superchunk.
Yeah, Kinko's wound up employing three of us.
Uh-huh.
Over the years, and they were very nice about letting us go on tour, you know, take weeks off and come back to work.
Yeah, it was always key to find that kind of a job. So mm-hmm. Could you describe, without getting too deep into this, and let's just do it as cleanly as we can, the money stuff. You're a label, you like a band, you want the band to come out, you want to represent this band. Can you describe how Merge Records decided to deal with that? And when it started to become profitable in some way?
Well, when we were doing 7 inches, it was more like, hey, we'd like to put out your 7-inch. And they would go, okay. And then we'd do it. And we'd go, we'll give you 100 copies of the 7-inch as payment. And then any payment we got for what we sold went back into the label.
And how many did you usually press of the 7-inches?
Like
if they got 100, so they got one-fifth or something.
Or 1,000. Usually we were trying to give them 10%
Of the pressing.
Of the pressing. And, you know, then they could sell it at shows and make some money.
They would make more money that way than we could have given them from the end.
Interesting.
Profit on a single, probably.
20 years later, and more, you know, I mean, you know, maybe we shouldn't go really specific, but or maybe it is. Maybe it's flat across the board. You know, it doesn't matter who it is. You have the same deal. How does it work?
We took a model from Touch and Go, and instead of doing what's a standard record industry deal, which is a royalty rate, you know, it gets kind of complicated, which is one reason that we didn't do it. You know, 18% of the dealer price minus a packaging deduction, all this stuff, you know, like we saw that in deals, like, and
we're
Matador's
just like,
yeah, it's and like so that. Touch and Go's concept seems so much more simple. If the record makes a profit, then we all share the profit.
Mm-hmm.
And so we work on a profit split basis with bands.
So let's talk about the real fun part, which is the music. What started getting you excited? When did you feel that you had this entity that was making a mark on the rest of music out there?
It wasn't long before I felt like it was making some mark.
Okay.
I mean, even the Angels of Epistemology 7-inch that we put out, people were into it. It was weird. It was interesting. We got a letter. We were going through the files recently for this book to just, you know, for images, for archival images for the book. But I found, and I had forgotten about this, a letter from Chrysalis. They had read a positive review of this Angels of Epistemology 7-inch, and they wanted a copy because they were interested in the band.
Huh.
They wanted me to send them a free copy.
No, Chrysalis
was
heard
the Angels, if you've heard the Angels of Epistemology,
we should hear it, yeah.
Let's, you'll understand how hilarious that is.
Okay, so let's do this. And the book you're talking about is called Our Noise, A Story of Merge Records. That book comes out, what, in the fall?
September 15th, I think, is when the book comes out.
And this is the Angels or just Angels of
Angels
Epistemology?
Angels of Epistemology,
okay,
yeah.
Great.
Some major label material right there.
Chrysalis was putting out stuff, you know, Jethro Tull and Steel Eye Span, and you know, not that.
That's true. Maybe they thought they had the next Jethro Tull on their hands. Well, you know, I mean, it's funny, like, you know, when Laura's saying, you know, feeling like we had made some sort of mark because a record like that gets a few reviews, and it sounds kind of funny now, but it's true that if you grow up finding out about the records that you love from reading, you know, a fanzine like Maximum Rock and Roll or something like that, then when you put out a single and it gets a review in a magazine like that, even though it's just like a tiny little paragraph or something, you feel like, wow, like this stuff is in the world. You know what
I mean?
We
made it.
Yeah.
That's right.
So it's all relative, I guess. But at the time, that is how you could find out about stuff, you know?
Take me to another landmark record, let's say, in the middle 90s for you all that, you know, put Merge Records solidly, even more solidly on the map for people.
In the late 90s, there was a few records that came out that, you know, kind of eclipsed what Superchunk was doing and reached a broader audience than Superchunk would have reached. And one of those was the Magnetic Fields record, which was 69 Love Songs.
Right, which I remember producing a piece for All Things Considered back then. So
it's an amazing record.
Let's play something.
Really blew people away.
Yeah, totally did. You want to pick it?
How about Come Back from San Francisco?
You talk about the late 90s and Neutral Milk Hotel. How was that record received, the first one, and then Aeroplane over the sea? How did that do for you initially? Because a lot of these records are slow builders, slow growers.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first one was received enthusiastically by a small group of people.
And small is what? 100, 500, 1,000? What is small back then?
I'd say 3,000 to 5,000 maybe.
Oh, not initially.
That's
you don't think
big.
So?
That's big.
That would have been huge.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean,
maybe 3,000 on this low end.
Over a year?
Yeah, like over a year, you know. We kind of figured the second record would, you know, be a similar thing. And
maybe 5,000.
And it maybe, you know, and it did kind of start in a similar way. And then it really grew. And, you know, 10 years later, I mean, it continues to grow, actually.
Can you tell us how many of each record, roughly, these things have sold? 100,000? 150,000?
I don't know the figure for On Avery Island, but I know that in the Aeroplane Over the Sea, the second album has sold about 250,000 copies at this point.
Well, let's play a bit of it, because it's too good to pass. What do you want to hear? We'll throw something at you. How's that?
Yeah, do it.
Okay.
Ghost, I know you live within me. Feel as you fly in thunder clouds above the city into one that I love. With all that was left within me until we tore into. Now wings and rings, and there's so many. I
Hard for me to stop that record.
The
song
reminded,
is Ghost. Yeah, sorry.
It reminded me of how I think a lot of the initial sales of the record were fueled by people seeing them live, and the intensity and the joy that came off the stage when they played. It gives me chills to think about it. I loved watching them play so much.
Is that how you decided to put them on your label? Seeing them?
No, actually, we hadn't seen them.
I don't even think Jeff had a touring band when we first started working with them with Avery Island.
Yeah. On Avery Island, I think he recorded pretty much, it was mostly him playing everything.
But I mean, like when the drums come in on that song and it's like changes the whole thing, and then you like really kind of get an idea about what you're in for, you know. I mean, that's, to me, like that's one thing that's so incredible about that record and the success of that record is that it's a very affecting record, but it's not incredibly commercial sounding by any means, you know, and it's very raw. Like the sound, it's like it's well produced by Robert Schneider, you know, but it's very raw and emotional, and it's stuff that, you know, you can see it connecting with a certain amount of people, but it is kind of amazing like how many people when they first hear it, they're like, whoa, like where has this been? You know what I mean?
Neutral Milk Hotel is sort of a good leaping off point for the idea that, like, if that record came out now, it would be completely different than it was its life cycle coming out when it did.
In other words, it would have burst on the scene as opposed to be this slow build. Is that what you're getting
at? I think so. Imagine it might have been. Yeah.
And that's because of the communication, the ability to tell an awful lot of people at the very same moment is the difference. Is that?
I think so.
Yeah.
Now,
and just more people have access to the underground than did then. It's easier to find it.
Do you like that?
I think it's good. It basically means a lot of people were deprived of alternatives in the past musically. You know, they had to rely on their local mall record store as the source of their music.
Well, how about
to me, I think that one of the downsides, though, is that it creates a feeling of some things being predetermined. You know what I mean? In other words, like that record, when people would hear it, was kind of a revelation because they didn't know what to expect, or like when they saw the band live, they didn't know what to expect now, you know, at that point. But now there would be a big buildup, and then people would, you know, hear a couple songs a month and a half before it came out, and they would share them around, and you know, there's just good and bad things, but I feel like it's, you know, we tried recently to put out a Spoon single as a surprise, and it's just really difficult to do, you know, to do anything that is surprising to people or that takes people a little bit off guard, you know, or present people as something that they weren't expecting, because the mechanisms of anticipation are everywhere.
It gets me a little bit to the idea of file sharing and so forth. Maybe we mentioned that 250,000 figure before. Many more people have heard this, and not just because they went to their friend's house to listen to it, right? So where do you guys fall on that whole idea of people sharing music not in ways that money exchanges hands?
There are good and bad things about it, I guess. The good thing is people get exposed to things that and try things that they wouldn't if they had to pay for it. And it would all be okay if there was a responsibility in that they would then, if it was something they liked, they would then go and buy it.
We have this series called First Listen. People listen to the whole record for a week online, and then it's off our site, and then they go buy it or not buy it. The folks with Moby did that with a single of his. They basically gave it away for one of the singles, gave it away for a week. You can download the thing for a week. It turns out to be now like one of the biggest selling things Moby has ever done. Having given it away for a week or two, then making available for sale, it's one of the biggest things he's ever done. So it is a strange thing in that, you know, the obvious scare was always, if you give it away, no one will buy it. But
I mean, I think that you have to, at a certain point, if you set yourselves up, like Merge has, to be a label that caters to music fans and people who love music and people who want to support artists, you kind of have to just trust that they're gonna do that. You know what I mean? And like Laura said, I mean, I think it's great that people get to hear something for free and then make a decision about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we stream new albums on our site before they come out so people can listen to it for a while before they can buy it and that kind of thing. You know, Wilco did that with their most recent record. And I feel like if the music is good, how can that really hurt you? You know what I'm saying? I mean, if someone says, well, I streamed it for 2 days and I was sick of it, so I'm not going to buy it. Well, maybe it just wasn't that good, you know, or it just wasn't for them. But I mean, in general, like, I think that that's a good thing. And for a lot of bands on Merge, even, you know, file sharing and people trading stuff, you know, sending MP3s around has probably really expanded the profile of some of the up and coming artists on Merge, you know. But at this and you know, with a label like with a band like Arcade Fire or Spoon, who's really selling a lot of records, those are the bands I think where you're losing the most sales to something just getting shared or people just downloading it for free off of a aggregator or something like that.
Merge in 20 years from now, I mean, can you imagine it? Can you paint that picture?
I can imagine it, yes. I mean, you know, we've made it this far. I think we can keep going. But what it will be, I think we can't really plan. I think...
Do you know what you'd want it to be?
What it is now, I guess. You know, like a label that is friendly to artists and lets them do what they want to do and makes it available to people who want to hear it.
That's good philosophy. So it's 20 years. How are you guys celebrating? Let's talk about the ways you're going to celebrate 20 years from Merge.
Well, as Laura mentioned earlier, we did a book recently with a writer named John Cook, and it's called Our Noise, and it's a kind of a history of the label, and there's a big visual component to that with a ton of photographs and just scraps and stuff from the archives. So it's that's coming out in the fall. But before then, we've got a festival that we're putting on in Chapel Hill next week, or the 22nd through the 26th of July, with 33 bands playing. And we do it every 5 years, and it's going to be the biggest one yet. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Now, how about disc-wise? There's this cool thing of covers. Tell us quickly about that, and maybe pick one for us to go out on would be fun.
Well, we did a subscription-only box set for the where people subscribe and get CDs throughout the year that are curated by different artists and musicians and chefs, and where they pick their favorite Merge songs, and all the money's going to charity. And one of the discs in the box is actually a compilation of non-Merge bands that we like covering songs that came out on Merge.
And this is also available outside of the box set. You can buy it without having subscribed to it.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that are in the box that will also be in stores, and this is one of them that's out there now. It's called the box set's called Score, and that disc is called Score of the Covers.
Mm-hmm.
And the first song on it is one of my favorite covers on there. It's by a band called Quasi, and they cover a song by the 3Ds, and the 3Ds are from New Zealand, and they're getting back together to play our festival, actually, after not having played in over a decade, I think. So the song's called Beautiful Things.
That's great. It's been a pleasure. Mac McCollin and Laura Balance from Merge Records, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.